Welcome back to the History of South Africa podcast with me, your host, Des Latham. Episode 269, Bapedi Chief Sekhukhune's Cruel Fate and the Afrikaner Paradox. The Bapedi have a rich and textured history where religion and tradition are entwined to create a consciousness of life that is attractive to the naturally curious. Today, part of Limpopo Province, Bushveld, contains private game parks with Bapedi and other African names, including Moya, which has three meanings. It is used for wind, or breath, or the soul, roughly translated. It is something, they say, which cannot be seen but can be heard. When a sick person wheezes, you know they're alive, because you can hear their soul. It has not departed. At night, when there is stillness, and you pick up the faint sounds of someone speaking, and upon investigation you find no one, then you know it is the soul of a dead person. Parts of your body are moya, the lungs, blood, heart, liver, kidneys, and the sex organs, your head, your hair. It is also these parts which are most associated with or susceptible to disease. Your moya is like your iris or your fingerprint. There is no one else who has a copy of your moya. Humans cannot live without moya, but sometimes you can live without your sariti, your shadow, your reflection. But this is the supernatural representation. The Bapedi word for shadow and reflection in water or mirror is moriti. Your sariti is created at birth when you cast your first shadow. For extremely traditional Bapedi, it is bad manners to step on another's shadow or allow your shadow to fall on someone else. Traditional healers won't work at midday when the sun is directly overhead because it is said the spirits of the dead are sleeping. If you dream about someone, it is their sariti you see, and the modern sense of this concept is one of personality and dignity. Dacha and alcohol make the sariti mobile. It wanders about. Dacha yarena mamotacha ati bapapedi. This friend of ours isn't one. They are two. People do not die. They trek away from their flesh and live elsewhere. Kudupana, a style of sleeping with the arms and the knees pulled in closely to the body. It's how an unborn child lies in the womb before birth and how the Bapedi were buried in ancient days. The Quechua of the Peruvian Andes buried their dead like this. So too the Celts and ancient Europeans. There is a human connection across eons and continents about how burials work. Hunter-gatherer communities across Southeast Asia, notably in Vietnam and Indonesia, do this too, and in the Near East. This was the standard mode for burial millennia before extended burials became common. Before the era of mummification, ancient Egyptians buried their dead in a fetal position facing west. Old sand and koikoi graves feature the deceased in the kudupana position. It is imperative to strengthen one's sariti against the onslaught of outside forces, and it's upon this principle that the logic of cause and effect, which means you take love potions, wear amulets, cast spells. Coupled with this is the conception that natural objects have latent powers too. Chief Sekhukhune of the Bapedi knew this when he built his fortress in a steep-sided narrow valley south of the Olifants River at what was called his stadt. While the British were focusing on the Zulus in 1879, Sekhukhune was sparring with other English authorities along the Olifants, and the towns of Lydenburg and Middelburg were reinforced. The Bapedi chief wanted to expand his territory across the Steelpoort River, and his raiding parties were bothering the Boers there. His position was further strengthened by a drought, which meant British and Boer commanders could not take the field. There wasn't enough grass and water for the oxen and horses. The dreaded horse sickness also broke out, further complicating the Transvaal government's plans. It was the arrival of Sir Garnet Wolseley in Pretoria in September 1879 to assume the office of governor that made matters more difficult for Sekhukhune. Wolseley thought that news of Quechua Kampani's capture would convince the Bapedi chief that it was futile to continue fighting the British, but Sekhukhune flatly refused to believe the Zulu king had been taken. Wolseley sent word to the Bapedi they were going to have to pay tax and that the chief would have to pay a fine of 2,500 head of cattle. The crafty chief wasn't going to let things move too quickly. He sent word back that he would agree to a truce while thinking about it. Then he gave his people time to sow and reap their crops. Besides, there was something else he knew which the British didn't. The Boers had come to him and explained that he should hang on, because they were going to drive the accursed English out of the Transvaal themselves. Boer farms were no longer raided. Unfortunately, Sekhukhune miscalculated. For one, the horse sickness fever abated. Secondly, Wolseley was a very different commander compared to others sent to try and pacify him. A more modern thinker, he put together a highly mobile force of 8,000 Swazi warriors, 400 mounted Africans, and 400 settlers, and he called it the Lydenburg Column. 3,000 settlers and British troops and 2,500 Africans comprised the main column. Wolseley established Fort Edward on the southeast bank of the Olifants River, about 40 kilometers from the Bapedi Stad. The main column advanced and seized Waterkoppie, 5 kilometers from the Stad, on the 25th of November, 1879. Unseen, the Lydenburg column outflanked Sekhukhune's position beyond the range of hills and waited for orders to attack from the rear. The defenders had reinforced the approaches with rocks and even trenches, which intersected the caves and the stone walls. Directly opposite the Stad was a strategic hill called Fatinkopi, which was strongly defended, a place of tumbled rocks typical of the Lowveld, where many hiding places could be found. At times it loomed 150 feet over the attackers. Sekhukhune's Stad was large. A slough of 3,000 huts stretched 4 kilometers across the valley along the foot of the southern mountain. The chief had already made his way to occupy one of the large caves at the top of the Stad, from where he could look down on the coming battle. He had fought African and European soldiers for decades. The Swazi, other Bapedi chiefs, the Boers, the British. He'd never been defeated, so he hadn't even made plans to escape from this cave. Minutes before dawn on the 26th of November, the first shell whizzed into Fatinkopie and the battle commenced. The Bapedi sounded their horns and the British blew their bugles, whereupon the Lowveld echoed with the sounds of small arms fire and artillery. Sekhukhune's men were in rifle pits along the front of the Stad, but the British overcame these rapidly, and the Bapedi were forced to withdraw to the broken ground on the slopes. Then the attack slowed as Bapedi fire increased from behind the rocks. Suddenly, the Swazi warriors and mounted column appeared on the summit, poised like the tail of a scorpion. The Swazis a spectacle, with their crane feathers on their heads and wrapped in leopard skins. They swooped down on the caves. The defenders were overcome in minutes. Then the Swazis set fire to the entire Stad. 3,000 huts went up in flames. By 9:30, Sekhukhune city was a smouldering ruin, the bodies of the British, the Swazi and the Bapedi covering the ground. On the Fatinkopie, some Bapedi warriors clung on. They had been shelled since dawn, but refused to surrender. Wolseley's men surrounded the kopie, and then a rocket was fired, the signal to charge from all four sides. The Bapedi were waiting, hidden behind the huge granite boulders and inside the dark caves, as well as their breastworks they'd built. When the attackers began pushing them back, they retreated into the largest cave. Despite the proliferation of muskets and rifles, most of the attackers actually were wounded in these confrontations, stabbed and clubbed. By 10:30, the defenders were in these caves and the kopie was in British hands. The caves now were full of warriors as well as women and children. All refused to surrender. Wolseley ordered some of the gun cotton to be blown up, which produced mini blasts, but the Bapedi were not overawed. Some even rushed out to cut the fuses. These were men who'd gone to work in the diamond fields and knew how to deal with explosives. It was decided to starve them into submission. Pickets were placed around the kopie that night. The British promised anyone who came out would be spared. So the next morning, most of the women and children emerged. Within a few days, all the warriors were out and spared as promised. Meanwhile, the old wily Sekhukhune remained in his cave unseen. That was until he and a handful of men made a rush for the summit, and the Swazi contingent chased after him. They eventually located the Bapedi chief in another cave about 15 kilometers away. This was too deep and narrow to enter, and the Swazi warriors were called back because of the bad blood between them and the Bapedi. The British believed they'd kill him outright if they entered. At 6 o'clock in the morning of the 2nd of December, the half-starved Sekhukhune finally surrendered. The exact number of Bapedi killed is unknown, but presumed to be in the thousands, and they went down fighting, killing at least 6,000 Swazis and 13 British troops. On the 9th of December 1879, Sekhukhune was led into Pretoria and eventually joined Cetshwayo Khampande and Amahlubi chief Langali Balele on Robben Island. His capture led to the collapse of the Bapedi kingdom. The British informed the chiefs that they would be forgiven for past actions, but no successor would be appointed to replace Sekhukhune. Each headman would be responsible for their local village. Everyone would now pay tax. All killings without trial would end, and criminal cases would be heard by an English magistrate. All firearms would be surrendered. By mid-1880, 1,350 guns had been collected, and the Bapedi began paying tax in the form of cattle. When you consider that 2,041 guns had been seized after the battle at Sekhukhune Stad, you can see how well armed they were. His Stad area was cleared of all citizens. They were all moved to flat ground near Matebi's Kop, as well as Malayo's Kop. They were not allowed to live anywhere near hills. So afraid were the British of the Bapedi's skill in fighting in mountains. The king would only be released from prison after the coming First Boer War and went home in 1881. But he didn't survive long. The ambitious chief Mampuru had him murdered in 1882. But the Boers of the Suid-Afrikaanse Republic came for his revenge, captured Mampuru and hanged him in Pretoria in November 1883. According to the blueprint for the Transvaal that had been devised by Administrator Theophilus Shepstone and Cape Governor Sir Bartle Frere, the defeat of the Bapedi would be proof to the Boers of the British good faith. It would demonstrate that British rule was a blessing. To their considerable astonishment, this act actually put the final nail in the coffin of Confederation, as the Cambridge History of South Africa puts it. Since the British took control of the Cape in 1805, their policy had been grounded in the belief that once they won allegiance of the Dutch and the Huguenot settler population, peace and prosperity would be guaranteed. Despite warnings from all who really understood the people who came to be called Afrikaners, London clung to this foolish ideal. When they arrived in South Africa, the British had told African kings and chiefs that they would fight for their rights. But these men were all sold down the river. They were subordinated to the English obsession with race. It was a time of the emergence of evolution as a major theory, and in the whimsical eyes of the Eton-educated upper-class twits who were sent to South Africa, blacks were on a lower evolutionary rung of the human ladder. It was how they also approached the Boer republics. These too represented white people on a lower rung who had to learn how to become civilized, i.e. British, and climb to the top rung, so to speak. Frere and Shepstone were both steeped in this narrative, this trope, grounded in what passed as scientific facts about race. It is a worldview we still encounter in the shady porches of global politics, a slow-moving sediment of the past. The rigid adherence to racial boundaries acts as a sort of psychic fortress, built out of a trembling, inherited terror of a world that has already moved on. A bias against the other, an overt message of power that is really a statement of one's own shaky identity. The leaders of the Orange Free State and the Zuid-Afrikaanse Republic had a different dream, and it wasn't based in evolutionary theory. They had experienced 40 years of independence from the yoke of English rule, and this was blossoming into a national identity and destiny. The old Dutch had been replaced in many parts of South Africa by a language that was the forerunner of Afrikaans. They began to resent the label of Boer and were calling themselves Afrikaners as a recognition of their home continent, Africa. The British had recast political and social institutions in their mould. English became the language of public service and the judiciary. Dutch speakers, the Afrikaners, on the Raad der Gemeente and Hof van Landros and Himraden, were replaced by predominantly English-speaking magistrates and town trustees. In Cape Town and surrounding settlements, the Afrikaners came under strong pressure to abandon their language and customs altogether. Some prominent families became fully anglicized, known as Anglo-Afrikaners. Most, however, felt they were treated by the British as wastrels, mentally deficient, and continued to reinforce their own ethnicity, not only as white, but as Afrikaans-speaking whites. The editor of the Suid-Afrikaan newspaper wrote, "A colonist of Dutch descent cannot become an Englishman, nor should he strive to be a Hollander." The connection to the Netherlands, Holland, unquestioned before, was becoming of secondary importance. By 1870, the Afrikaners insisted that Dutch remain the language of the Dutch Reformed Church and not English. Language and religion were vital elements of their ethnic identity. Simultaneously, they saw themselves as elevated above blacks, separated themselves, and developed a race consciousness. Where their ancestors had married Khoikhoi women, even black women, this steadfast belief in being part of an almost mythical lost tribe of Israel was going to get South Africa into a lot of trouble. The Suid-Afrikaan newspaper went on an intellectual rampage, objecting to the practice of teaching both black and white children together, sitting in the same classes. This was in the 1870s. This national consciousness gradually matured along the frontiers. The Great Trek, its foundation, which was another myth, because the Voortrekkers did not emigrate as a nation. They left the Cape as groups of free citizens, who could go anywhere they chose, referring to themselves as immigrants or Dutch Afrikaans immigrants. They competed with each other. There was a great deal of bad blood between Trek leaders. On the other hand, the Trek Boeren were part of a separate expansion process and saw themselves as loyal British subjects, repeatedly requesting that they be recognized as that by the colonial government. If this sounds bizarre and unbelievable, have a read through Afrikaans historian F.R. van Jaarsveld's Levende Verlede, which is an excellent source of this history. The Trek Boeren were migrating farmers and a class of frontiersmen who had been expanding the boundaries of the Cape colonies since the late 17th century, long before the British arrived, and long before the so-called Great Trek. While the Voortrekkers of the 1830s left the Cape specifically to escape British rule, many of the Trek Boeren, who had already settled across the Orange River, had a completely different relationship with the Crown. Unlike the Voortrekkers, who declared independent republics, like the Natalia Republic or the Orange Free State and Zuid-Afrikaanse Republic, many Trek Boer communities repeatedly petitioned the British governor in Cape Town to extend the colony's borders to include them. This wasn't necessarily out of patriotism in the modern sense. It was practical. They wanted legal titles to their land, protection from indigenous raids, and access to the Cape markets. In the early 19th century, before the rise of organized Afrikaner nationalism, many Cape Dutch descendants genuinely identified as British subjects. Van Jaarsveld highlights that the sharp binary divide we imagine today was actually quite porous back then. This is a strange and haunting paradox, looking back from the prism of modern history. We often imagine a clean break where they deserted the crown for the wilderness, but if we look closer, we find the Trek Boeren, who didn't want to leave the empire, they wanted the empire to follow them. The Voortrekkers and their descendants who lived in the Orange Free State and the ZAR, who escaped the crown, not for the wilderness, but for the promised land. They definitely did not want the empire to follow them. Thus, the paradox. Whereas slavery and settlement stimulated a racial consciousness, the Afrikaners' clash with British imperialism brought the concept of a distinct white political entity to the fore. The annexation of Basutoland in 1868, the Diamond Fields 1871, and then the Transvaal in 1877 had shocked Afrikaners into the awareness that they were a spiritually connected people. The paradox is further profoundly made whole by the fact that it was the British pressure on a people who were fractured that made them more cohesive. It drove them together. They now appear to share not only the same language and faith, but the same destiny and the same enemy. This, of course, did not mean that Afrikaners were completely unified. Far from it. And there were a slew of views about who actually was a ware Afrikaner or not. When the Afrikaner Bond was founded in 1880, it morphed into a political party. Facing the leaders of the Bond was this question. Should it mobilize the Afrikaners exclusively, or should it attempt to attract votes from across the lines of color and culture? Afrikaans developed as a contact language in the Cape. It was widely spoken by Khoisan and mixed-race communities. In fact, groups such as the Griqua, the Orlam, and other mixed-descent communities, along with leaders like Jonker Afrikaner, were among the earliest speakers and played a key role in shaping the language. Despite this fact, the Bond was not going to allow non-whites into its ranks. On the Highveld, 6,000 Transvaal farmers had gathered at Wonderfontein in December 1879 and hoisted the Vierkleur, the flag of independence, against the express orders of the new governor of the Transvaal, Wolseley. He had replaced Bartel Freer, who had been fired as High Commissioner for Natal in the Transvaal. Shepstone had also been replaced as administrator by Sir Owen Lanyon, a man who was completely clueless about the Boers and who made no effort to learn anything about them. Where Freer had been diplomatic, Wolseley was a blunt military man, and where Shepstone had listened, Lanyon was tactless and autocratic. The stage was now set for a collision between two uncompromising worlds, where dogmatic leaders were destined to lock horns like rutting stags on the Highveld, neither willing to yield an inch of their respective certainties. Next episode, We'll take a closer look at the start of the First Anglo-Boer War. Please rate the podcast on your favorite platform. I have a little newsletter coming out. You can go to desmondlatham.blog and sign up there. Until next, tot ziens.